Hello and welcome to Undivided. I'm Brandi Cruz. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your continuing commitment to give common sense a comeback. Happy Friday to all of you. And also a weekly reminder that you can become an Undivided subscriber and directly support this independent podcast. You can do that for $5 a month at patreon.com/undivided or by becoming a contributor on my Locals community. All right, coming up today on Fridays with Friends, we're going to be joined by Todd Myers. He is the author of the new book, Time to Think Small. And he and I are going to have what I found to be a fascinating conversation about how we can achieve smart, meaningful, and lasting change on environmental issues without taxing people to death.
You have to understand that politicians and agencies are responding to their own pressures, and that putting power in the hands of individuals to care for the environment is not only more effective, it's often more moral. And I think we ought not lose sight of that. And that is why I think conservatives need to have more confidence on these issues, because our approaches in empowering people and not politicians, it is the better approach. We just need to have the courage to say it.
Also on Florida Report, how much would you pay, if anything, to go to the inauguration of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis? Well, apparently some people might be willing to pay seven figures for that privilege, and perhaps the privilege of also getting buddy-buddy with the future president of the United States. But first, I want to start by talking about the Brittany Griner situation, the Brittany Griner story. First, let me just say, I'm so happy for her, for her family, for her friends, that she gets to come home. Regardless of how you feel about the politics of it all and how they got her home, we'll discuss that in a moment. What happened to Brittany Griner? You know, she was used as a pawn, very successfully, I might add, by Vladimir Putin. And yes, she broke Russian law, but it wasn't worth 10 years in a penal colony. And I don't think Russia ever intended to have her serve 10 years in a penal colony. The idea was to make the situation bad enough that the U.S. would do something that would benefit them. So very happy for Brittany Griner, for her friends and for her family. That being said, I think there's a lot of very reasonable concerns and questions to have about the circumstances under which Russia traded her. We know that they traded her for a guy who is nicknamed the Merchant of Death, who assisted the Taliban in Afghanistan, who used child soldiers, who was an arms dealer known for using torture and maiming people to get information. It's like an all-around bad guy. And this was a prisoner swap, Brittany Griner for the Merchant of Death. And so there are a lot of questions, of course, about is that a fair swap? Is that a swap that's in the interest of not only the United States, but the world? And of course, Paul Whelan didn't get to come home, you know, a U.S. Marine who's been there for a long time now. And all indications are that the U.S. wanted it to be Paul Whelan and Brittany Griner for the Merchant of Death, but that Russia refused to budge on Paul. And so the U.S. characterized it as, look, it was either we bring one American home or we bring no American home. And I tend to agree that, you know, I don't agree with the sentiment that if Paul couldn't come home too, you just leave Brittany Griner there to suffer. Like, if they're going to be willing to release her and you've already committed to this prisoner swap, or you've already entertained the idea, then it's not like you're just going to, oh, well, if they won't let Paul go, then Brittany's got to sit there and suffer as long as Paul does. But of course, you know, the broader conversation here is about the precedent that this sets, that you have this notable American that Russia no doubt saw the opportunity to use as a pawn. And the second they could find a reason, and they could probably have made up a reason to detain her, they did so. And now you have the U.S. willing to give up this very dangerous man to get her back. Chuck Todd on Meet the Press was questioning a spokesperson for the Biden administration for the National Security Council and asked, I think, what everybody was thinking is, hey, I thought that the U.S. didn't negotiate with terrorists. And I very much agree with Chuck Todd that Vladimir Putin amounts to a terrorist.
The White House has actually actively worked against private citizens in other cases at times, lecturing private citizens and paying ransoms, for instance, to get detained Americans home. It does feel like there's not a one policy anymore. that you...
Well, let me just...
So try to square that, because, again, I know of, and you and I may know of the same private citizen, but we know of some private citizens that, try to work around, and the administration doesn't like it when there's negotiating on that front. But here you were negotiating, essentially, with a terrorist in Vladimir Putin.
We were negotiating with Russian officials for the release of Brittany Griner. We are today, Chuck, negotiating and talking to the Russian and those same officials about getting Paul Whelan home, and that's not going to stop. We are doing it in other countries all around the world, as you would expect we would. And woe to us if we weren't willing to sit down and have discussions with people with whom we have very significant right. differences, like the Russians, if we weren't looking after American citizens. Now, lots of efforts go on at various levels, not always in the U.S. government to help us do that, but this was a U.S. government deal.
No, I understand that, but there's times when the U.S. government frowns upon it when it's done, and here the U.S. government is leaning forward to do it. And trust me, if I were that American citizen, I'd want the government to do whatever it took to get me out. Hard stop. But, as you know, how does this not only encourage more kidnappings of prominent Americans if they go overseas?
Sadly, kidnappings and wrongful detentions are not something new. Brittany was not the first one, mm-hmm. clearly. And there will be more, sadly, going forward. And what we're trying to do is we put some additional sanctions in place to try to inhibit hostage taking, as it were. We've also now worked with the State Department to label countries as detention risk. We recommend that if you're going to travel, an American, travel overseas for pleasure or for business,
right.
that you go to the State Department's website, you look at what the designation is for the country that you're going in, so that you can go in informed about the potential risk. And if you're wrongfully detained, even if you do everything right, and you get wrongfully detained, you need to know that the President of the United States, President Biden, is going to do what he has to do to try to get you home to your family. And sometimes he's willing to even make very difficult decisions like this one to make it happen.
You know, we all wish we could go back and tell Brittany Griner, don't go to Russia. Certainly don't smuggle hash oil into Russia, even if it's accidental. Those are kind of no-brainers. But I also think to that point of what was being discussed there is I think Russia should be a no-go zone for Americans. I mean, and you can say like, hey, you're going at your own risk, and I get that. But also if the U.S. has already said, well, we're willing to swap to get you back, we're going to do whatever we can to get you back, you're traveling to Russia, frankly, is a risk to the American people and to the safety of the world if there's some sort of prisoner swap that lets a dangerous Russian out. The risk, if you are a notable American, of being used by Vladimir Putin, even if he has to completely manufacture something to imprison you, the risk is there. And I just don't know why anyone would risk it. You know, and in Brittany Griner's situation, they've said, well, she wasn't making enough on the WNBA in the U.S., so she had to take on this great risk of playing basketball in Russia. Come on. No amount of money is worth what Brittany Griner went through. And there are many, many other places overseas that are not hostile to Americans where you can go play ball overseas if you need to. The idea that we need to have Americans in Russia playing ball is ridiculous. So honestly, I mean, this is something that, again, it sets a dangerous precedent that the next notable American who goes into Russia, I mean, I don't see why Putin wouldn't scoop them up and use them to his advantage. So this creates, I mean, like I said, I'm happy for Brittany Griner, very happy for her friends and family. I know there are a lot of them here locally in Washington State in terms of her friends that she's played ball with. But this has created a really challenging situation for not only the U.S. but the world. And there's this thought now that Vladimir Putin is using or wants to use the Merchant of Death in the war against Ukraine. I was reading some reporting from Politico on that. And it's like, okay, so we have, you know, put all this aid and all this effort into helping Ukraine, and then we turn around and send this deadly war criminal back to Vladimir Putin so he can help kill Ukrainians. So there are a lot of legitimate criticisms to have of the Brittany Griner swap. I think you can have really, really wanted her back to her family, really, really felt bad for this unjust sentence that Russia handed down, but also really be concerned about the possible ramifications. Today on Fridays with Friends. I've got a friend out with a new book on a subject that I'm still learning a lot about. And those are my favorite subjects to discuss because I just get to absorb information. Todd Myers, who is the director of the Center for Environment at the Washington Policy Center, has just put out a new book. It's called Time to Think Small, How Nimble Environmental Technologies Can Solve the Planet's Biggest Problems. Todd has been a career environmental nerd. He is a conservative who has a lot of, frankly, blunt things to say, even about his own party and how they really aren't bringing a lot to the table when it comes to solutions to some of our biggest environmental challenges. You know, he's critical of what Democrats are doing, but on the flip side, it's like, okay, well, what are Republicans going to bring to the table as well? And what his book is about, and one of the things we talked about at length, is about how we can solve some of these key environmental issues better if the government simply gets out of the way. Todd, welcome to Undivided. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
We're going to talk about your book. We'll give it lots of love today. Time to Think Small, How Nimble Environmental Technologies Can Solve the Planet's Biggest Problems. On the environment, is it a blind spot for Republicans?
I would say it's more than a blind spot. It is actually some Republicans actively oppose or actively resist talking about it for a variety of reasons. One is that environmentalism coming out of the 1970s became sort of synonymous with big government. And so there's a lot of conservatives, a lot of Republicans who believe that talking about the environment is just sort of a Trojan horse for socialism. And the reason they believe that is because sometimes it is. There are people who say, like, you know, we're doing this and we need socialism. So there was a resistance. And so Republicans shy away. And so that, I think, is a problem because then on an issue where conservatives in their daily lives care, right? If you look at a map, you can see where the red parts of the state are, is where the nature is, ironically. But it's not just that they shy away or it's not just a blind spot. They actively sort of resist sometimes talking about it because they're afraid that if they say out loud, I care about the environment, what am I committing myself to? And so that needs to change.
So we'll talk about some of your thoughts for kind of fixing the way that environmental policy is pushed and works. But give people a little bit of a background. Why is it a topic that you care so much about?
Yeah. So when I got out of college, if you had told me that I was going to work in environmental policy, I've told you you were crazy. The people who I knew in college who worked on the environment or interested sort of looked weird and smelled bad. but in 2000, I went to work on a campaign for Commissioner of Public Lands. We elect the manager of millions of acres of state lands in Washington State. And so I ran that campaign and we won. Well, I knew about running campaigns. I didn't know about the environment in 2000. So I went to work for the State Department of Natural Resources as part of the executive team there. And I spent time walking around forests, I mean, all across Washington State with foresters and biologists and other experts. And I remember one time at the end of the sort of the first year being in a forest with a forester and saying, this is really fascinating. And what you're telling me, I don't hear anywhere in the media or in the public discussion. And he sort of shook his head and was like, oh yeah, you're not going to hear this, any of this in public. And I thought, this, now I'm really interested. It's not just that I enjoy being out here, but it's fascinating. It's sort of intellectually challenging. And so that was 2001 and here it is 2022 and I'm still doing it. And I really enjoy it. And it's such an interesting and important topic.
Explain your current role.
So I'm the environmental director at the Washington Policy Center, where I have been since 2005. As I said, I worked at the State Department of Natural Resources on their executive team. And then currently I'm a member of the Puget Sound Salmon Recovery Council, where we're trying the state board, where we're trying to prioritize salmon recovery projects. And then I also was just appointed to the Hanford Advisory Board, where we're overseeing the nuclear cleanup there. So I do a lot of environmental stuff.
Busy, busy man.
Yeah.
So as someone who works for the Washington Policy Center, I'm assuming you define yourself as a conservative, as a Republican.
Center right, I generally say.
Center right. Are you welcomed into those environmental conversations in Washington State with open arms by Democrats?
Sometimes yes, sometimes absolutely not. there are plenty of folks who don't want to talk to me. But I have a shocking number of friends who are deep in the environmental community, and I think people would be surprised at some people who I talk with and am very friendly with on a regular basis. And like on the Salmon Recovery Council, I know that I am often a minority of one, but people listen to me and they talk to me, and they're, what's interesting is that there are a surprising number of times when I say things in public, and then people in the environmental left will reach out to me privately and say, thank you for speaking up because it's driving me crazy. And so there is definitely sort of a political barrier to a lot of people speaking out, but there are a lot of people on the environmental left who are sincere environmentalists who are frustrated that we're not solving these problems. Like conservatives who are afraid of saying things for what it means in public about the environment, there are people on the left who are just like that, who are afraid of speaking out against, you know, sort of current policy and the way we do policy, because they're afraid that it undermines, you know, some things that they see. But when you get into the environmental community and the environmental issues, you find that there are a lot of people who don't agree with you sort of generally on politics, but will agree with you on individual environmental issues.
You used a phrase there, a sincere environmentalist.
Yeah.
What does it take to be a sincere environmentalist in your estimation?
So I think that there are a lot of people who are political environmentalists, which is that environmentalism is just one part of their overall ideology. You hear this term intersectionality, right? How everything connects to everything else. And so environmentalism is sort of the talisman, but it is really just one part of sort of a pro-government, you know, big government left-wing ideology. But then there are plenty of people who got into environmentalism because they cared about the environment, because they cared about species, they cared about whatever else it is. And they are genuinely interested in finding environmental results, whatever the way that we do it.
Whoever gets the political win, they don't care.
It doesn't matter. And however you do it, and even if it's sort of contrary to their general ideology, they're like, great, let's do it. And you see some of that now in discussions among the left about reducing permit barriers, right? Which is ironic, because for so long, people on the right is like, permitting is a mess, we need to do something about it. And now people on the left are recognizing that. And I know we'll talk about my book in a second, but the foreword for my book was written by a young woman who works for a group called Wild Labs, which is funded by the World Wildlife Fund. So here I am on the center right. The foreword of my book is written by somebody who's clearly on the left. And there are those that sort of overlap with people who are sincere environmentalists.
And so I want to talk about sort of this split, because the environment is something that should be an issue that brings us together, right? Yeah. And you mentioned it, you know, where are people living amongst the environment? It's not in the middle of the city. And so it's kind of funny that it's like, there's this feeling that people who live in the cities and these liberals care more about the environment than people who are living on 100 acres out in Eastern Washington, you know, every single day. So on the, you sent me some, like, we were going to talk about your book, and you're like, I could also talk about XYZ. And I kind of laughed at a couple of them. One of them was, why Washington's climate policies cost so much but achieve so little. I was like, oh, Todd's petty. No, I'm just kidding. So what's an example of a climate policy that you believe has cost a lot? I'm assuming you mean monetarily.
Yeah.
But has done virtually nothing.
Yeah. So there's two costs. One, there is the direct cost, right? Just the cost of the taxpayers. But then there's the second thing, which is the opportunity cost. If you spend money on things that don't work, the problem just gets worse. Now you have to sort of go, oh, crap, we have to catch up because we've wasted time as well. So you can't overlook the opportunity cost. You know, Washington has missed every single one of its CO2 emissions targets, which is ironic because we have a governor who literally ran for president claiming that he was the climate governor and he was going to do for the U.S. what he's done for Washington State. Well, he missed every target. So what's the gap between the rhetoric and the reality? And I'll just give you a simple one, and this always freaks people out. We subsidize rooftop solar panels. Rooftop solar panels are perhaps the worst way to generate renewable energy that there is. The U.S. Energy Information Administration and a group called Lazard, they both do these analyses where they look at, okay, what are called the life cycle costs. How much does it cost in terms of investing in the capital and then paying for fuel and everything to generate electricity. Now, solar, the fuel is free, and everybody focuses on the fact that it's free, but the cost of installation is very high, and the cost of installation for rooftop solar is extremely high. It's the highest, right? Industrial solar, where you can do big areas, you can get some economies of scale. You can't get that with rooftop solar. So if you're looking for ways to invest, if you say, yes, government should spend money to reduce CO2 emissions. Okay, let's just assume that's true. Where should we get the maximum bang for our buck? You would never spend it on rooftop solar.
What would you spend it on?
You would spend it on wind in the right places, because there are some windy places that produce a lot. You would spend it on industrial solar in Southwest United States. You would send it pump storage, which basically dams, but not dams, where you pump the water up when energy is cheap, and then you use it when energy is expensive or when there's a shortage of energy and things like that. There's lots of ways to generate electricity. They're very cheap. Rooftop solar is about the most expensive. And so if you want to maximize environmental benefit for every dollar you get, you would never spend it on rooftop solar. And you would never spend it in Western Washington.
Why is that, Tom?
Yes, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, which is Department of Energy, they have a map that shows the best and worst places for solar irradiance across the state, across the United States. Western Washington is the worst outside of Alaska. Alaska is very far north, but outside of Alaska, Western Washington is the worst. So we here in Western Washington subsidize the most expensive form of solar energy in the worst place in the country to do it. That is a mess, right? That indicates that it is about politics and symbolism, not about results.
But there's nothing against like a private citizen who says, hey, I want to do my part to help the environment and I'm going to pay to install solar on my roof.
Great.
You're fine.
I think that's great. But the problem is that the whole system is set up to subsidize solar. There are federal subsidies. There are state subsidies. There are federal or state requirements about that utilities have to pay a certain amount to buy back electricity. All of those things mean that the system is heavily subsidized. And so every time I say this, I get an email, and I guarantee I'll probably get an email, that says, you're an idiot, Myers. I have solar panels, and I am making money. So just for full disclosure, I have solar panels on my house because the house that we bought had them. And guess what? I get paid. I think it's ridiculous. I want to stop it. So I am arguing against my own interest here. But the reason that people make money on solar panels is not because the solar panels are effective at producing energy, they're effective at producing subsidies. And that's the benefit that people get is those government subsidies. If the government subsidies went away, suddenly they wouldn't be making money on their solar panels.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, Governor Inslee has set himself up as sort of the climate governor or the climate candidate. I believe his time in office is coming to an end. I know there is speculation he'll run again. I just highly doubt that that's true. Maybe he'll run for president again, you know, more power to him if he chooses to. But when he leaves at the end of 12 years, if we're going to assume that he will, what is one genuine environmental accomplishment that you believe he has achieved?
So I think that there's a few things that he's done right. One is at a time when a lot of environmentalists who are concerned about climate change were saying, we'll do anything except nuclear, he accepted nuclear. He said, yeah, nuclear's got to be part of the mix. We have actually nuclear power in Washington State. People don't realize it, but Seattle City Light uses more nuclear than they do wind and solar combined. So he said that. That's great. I think that it's nice to see that he is consistent in that way with his goals, what he says is a real concern. Early on, actually his first climate bill, I lobbied for, because his first climate bill said, look, here are all the best ways to reduce CO2 emissions ranked by effectiveness. We should follow this. Unfortunately, 2 years later, he completely turned against that. So I think that you see these sort of glimmers from time to time of things that he says that are good. But at the end of the day, I think that he has always found justification to do the political thing rather than the effective thing.
Is there something in these, we'll call it 12, I mean, I know there's 2 years left. I'm wishing time, I guess. I know there's 2 years left on his term, but is there something today that you would say would be his biggest failure on environmental policy?
Yeah, it is. It is not prioritizing effectiveness over politics.
Sure.
So, like I said, his own bill started, his first climate bill when he took office in 2013, was to prioritize expenditures based on effectiveness. Turning away from that, I think, was a big mistake. Mm-hmm. In 2016, there was a revenue neutral carbon tax that would increase the price of CO2 emissions and cut other taxes so that average taxpayers would basically pay the same, but they would have an incentive to reduce CO2 emissions because mm-hmm. because CO2 emitting energy cost a lot. He opposed that. And the reason he opposed that is he said, well, it doesn't give any money to government. So given a choice between raising the price of carbon emissions and funding government, he chose funding government.
Yeah.
So we have a new CO2 tax that is going into effect on January 1st of 2023, but he essentially delayed that 6 years for an issue that he calls an existential crisis. He also made it a political issue. There was bipartisan support for that revenue neutral carbon tax. One of the biggest opponents of it was actually the environmental left. So I think he had opportunities to find solutions that were bipartisan, that would be supported by both parties. And he ended up rejecting those and proposing things that were very partisan, very political, and have contributed to the divisiveness on this issue.
So you brought up something that I think is going to sneak up on a lot of folks, January 1st, the carbon tax, yeah. and what that's going to do to the cost of fuel. I know there's been some discussion around, oh, hey, you know, gas prices are going to go up on the first of the year. But can you explain essentially how this is going to work and how it results in higher prices at the pump?
It's not a straightforward, it's not like a gas. Typically, when people vote for a gas tax, it's 10 cents a gallon.
Yeah.
And then, you know, on the date that it goes up, you basically see an increase. You see it get passed along. Mm-hmm. And that's what economic research all shows, is that when you raise prices by a penny, a tax on gasoline, a penny a gallon, you see a penny a gallon increase in prices. Mm-hmm. This is not like that. This is it's a permit system. And what happens is that there are a limited number of permits that gas companies can buy, and they have to buy those permits for every gallon of gas. So because it's a market, the price of the permit is speculative and it will change over time. Sometimes they will need more and the price will go up. Sometimes they'll need less and the price will go down. So the Department of Ecology put out a study from McKinsey estimating what the cost of the permit would be.
Okay.
Okay. This is an estimate. This is a projection based on a variety of things. So they might be wrong, but their estimate translates to 46 cents a gallon. Now, because it's a permit, the auctions are regular, you might not see it go up 46 cents a gallon on January 1st. Mm. You might not see that amount until the middle of the year. I am almost certain that you will see prices go up compared to the rest of the country and compared to the states around us in January.
Well, because Governor Inslee has kind of tried to deny that this would have a negative result on gas prices.
He has denied.
Yeah. And so is it possible that you end up being wrong and he ends up being right, or the Department of Ecology ends up being wrong and he ends up being right?
Sure.
What would account for that if, you know, the Department of Ecology has said, this is our estimate, you guys have said, yeah, that sounds about right. What would account for gas prices not going up if that's what happens?
Gas prices don't go up. That would be really weird, because what that would mean is that the gas companies are basically eating all of that cost.
Which seems unlikely.
Which they don't do,
right?
Which research shows that they don't do. So that would be really weird.
Okay.
The minimum price that they have set is about 18 cents a gallon. So Department of Ecology said that if you have to buy a permit, the price can't go below 18 cents per gallon. So it may not go up 40, like I said, may not go up 46 cents a gallon. It may not go up 46 cents a gallon until later in the year, but every gas retailer knows that for every gallon of gas that they're going to sell, the equivalent is going to be 18 cents a gallon.
So somewhere in that range, we can expect it to kind of ebb and flow.
And the way you look at that is not, see, prices, there's so many things that influence prices. And this is the game that ecology and the governor plays. It's like, oh, no, this is not what affects prices. It's world markets. It's Ukraine. Well, of course, world markets in Ukraine affect it. But saying that increasing taxes also doesn't affect it is just a distraction. It's just demagoguery.
Well, it's not honest.
Right, exactly. So the way I look at it is that, you know, I compare U.S. average gas costs to Washington state gas costs. And so you see a gap right now that fluctuates within a range. And what I expect is that gap to get bigger. And so that's what I'll be tracking next year. And then, you know, the Department of Ecology, their numbers translate to 46 cents a gallon, but they said, oh, no, no, we ran a model. And our model says it's only going to be 5 cents a gallon. So I offered a bet. Great, let's bet.
What's the bet?
I will bet, well, my standard bet is $50 to charity.
Okay.
And I will bet if people think that it's going to be less than 20 cents a gallon gap or increase in that gap between Washington and the rest of the country by September, I'll pay $50 to your charity. If I win, you pay $50 to a group called Plastic Bank, which does work to clean up plastic in the ocean.
Well, that's a win-win.
Exactly.
Nobody loses.
Exactly.
I like it.
I have offered this. I will offer it again to folks at the Department of Ecology. They will promptly not respond to my email, I guarantee. But the notion that this is going to be 5 cents a gallon when their own estimates are 46 cents a gallon is ludicrous. Mm-hmm. I don't. And I've talked to friends of mine who are economists who do this economic modeling. And I'm like, can you explain to me how they might have gotten this number? And the best answer I got is like, oh God, these models, I just don't, I mean, nobody can figure it out, but that's what they're saying in public.
Well, and it's not as if the Department of Ecology has some vendetta against the governor and wants to make it look bad.
Well, and that's the problem is that their own analysis indicates the permit price translates to 46 cents a gallon. But then what they say is, oh, but that actually doesn't work. We ran it through a model and our model only says 5 cents a gallon. So they're sort of at odds with themselves, which is, I think what you see a lot in politics, which is they tell the truth, but then they cover themselves with some political stuff. And I think the modeling is political.
Any chance, because, you know, the continued kind of crush of inflation, gas prices have eased a little bit, but they're still not great compared to the rest of the country. Is there any chance or any avenue through which the governor could hold off on this increase?
No, he doesn't want to.
Okay.
He's full speed ahead. Right. I mean, this is he has made climate policy his sort of talisman. It's his reason for being. I think he is just playing for time and hoping that now once it's locked in, that there's no turning back. And he is willing to pay that price. I mean, he says it's an existential crisis, right? Which is that we're all going to die if we don't deal with this. So to him, 46 cents a gallon is a price worth paying, even if politically he has to deny it.
Yeah. You know, obviously you have some criticisms of the governor and of Democrats who are in the majority in Olympia who've pushed through some of these policies. But I think some people might argue, well, what are Republicans proposing?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, You can crap on someone's bad idea, but if you're not putting anything forth, like, what are you contributing to it? So to flip and talk about Republicans, and as you acknowledged at the beginning, it's more than a blind spot in some instances. It's active resistance. In our state, given the political makeup, what we saw in November, how critical do you think it is for Republicans to start embracing issues around the environment and climate and to start actively proposing solutions?
Well, I think it's absolutely critical for a couple of reasons. First is because our current approach isn't working, right? Mm-hmm. So just from a good public policy standpoint, we have to start proposing things that work. But there is this other element, which I think you're sort of hinting at, which is the political element, which is, okay, you know, you have to look like you at least care about
these issues.
Well, I
want you to care. Yeah. And for as a moderate independent, like, I do care about the environment.
Right.
You know, I am worried about our world and our planet. I think everybody should be. And so, yeah, I think that's one of – and it's something that's brought up to me by moderates who are like, I wish that they – because there's a feeling, and I don't know if it's fair across the board,
right,
that they just do not care about the environment at all. And I know that that's not fair, but that's the feeling, I guess, among some moderates, is that environment is not an issue they are prioritizing.
That Republicans are prioritizing.
Republicans.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that's exactly right. And it's hard. And Republicans sort of cast around for policies for some reasons we've already discussed. But they need to get in the game. And so I'll give you a perfect example of where they can do that, which is on forest health. So we just went through another summer where we had lots of smoke. People don't like the smoke for all the right reasons. And our forests keep catching on fire. The governor keeps blaming climate change, but actually it the primary, and what research from Forest Service and other folks shows is that the number one driver of the increase in forest fires that we're seeing is bad forest health and poor forest management. Mm-hmm. And we need to fix that. So there's an area where we can make progress, and it is an area that is widely agreed in the science. I did a video with the Colville Confederated Tribe, and one of the great things about Eastern Washington tribes, the Yakima and the Colvilles, is they do great forest management, because if their forests burn up, right, their tribal members on the reservation get in their ear about it, yeah, right? And so they have a direct connection to it and responsibility. And so there is a broad agreement on how to manage those forests. And I think that is an area where Republicans can take more active approach to say, not only this is good for our forests, it's good for, you know, habitat and wildlife and things like that, but it also keeps smoke out of our you know, cities and things like that. So it's an area where they can engage and take the lead.
But there's also been disagreement on that issue too. Hillary Frans, the Commissioner of Public Lands, it's sort of been her perennial political push to get a dedicated fund to deal with wildfire forest right. management and some other aspects of fighting wildfires. And she proposed it via an increase in, like, I think it was a fee rather right. than a tax, right, yeah. to insurance. Premiums, and Republicans push back against that, saying they don't want to raise insurance premiums. So, I mean, what could they do in exchange? Like, yeah. what is there a fundamental issue you have with Hillary Frans' proposal? Is it the fact that it comes with a tax increase?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, the problem is that the way you look at every environmental problem is an opportunity for a tax increase.
Well, some of it is going to cost money. Some of it's not free. We'll talk about some things that might not cost right. much money in a moment. But
the state, the lands that are best managed mm-hmm. are lands that generate revenue. You don't see many forest fires in private lands because they're well managed, because they have the revenue to do it. When I was at the Department of Natural Resources, we were required by 2015 to fix all culverts, fish blockages, to open up streams for fish on state lands. We actually were ahead of schedule. And the reason is that the state harvests timber on state lands to generate revenue for schools and a variety of other mm-hmm. things. But what we would do is we would take a portion of that revenue to fix the problems on the land. And there are two entities that did not do it. The Department of Transportation, because guess what? They're reliant on tax revenue. And the U.S. Forest Service, because guess what? They're reliant on tax revenue. Mm. And so when you make something contingent on taxes and the legislature, rather than on a sustainable stream of revenue, everywhere you see that, just about, you see environmental problems not being solved. Huh. Where you see a consistent stream of revenue, you see the ability to solve those problems. And so that, I think, is a fundamental problem, not just from an ideological standpoint of, for God's sakes, we don't need any more taxes, but it is a system that doesn't work because, and especially in Washington State, you can create a tax that is dedicated to something, but when the legislature has other ideas, they can take that money. So it's just not a sustainable way to solve these problems.
So let's talk about the book, because, you know, I think Governor Inslee in particular, you know, like you said, existential crisis, world's going to end. And there's this focus on these big ideas that can right. get a lot of attention. And what you argue in the book is it's time to think small. Yeah. Again, how nimble environmental technologies can solve the planet's biggest problems. And you write about some kind of case studies in this across the world of little things being done by people everywhere that you think, when they add up, can make a really big difference. So can you talk about some of the examples that you give in your book of things that are creative and just really effective?
Yeah. So I give a lot of examples in the book. And the reason I do that, actually, one of the earliest reviews of my book was that it is information overload.
information overload?
And the reason I do that is because a lot of times I talk about the theory, right? Free market environmentalism and the theory about why these things work. And people say, okay, that's nice, but give me some examples. And so I probably overdid the examples because I wanted to overcome that, but also because there are so many really cool ones. Mm-hmm. So I'll give a very big one. It's one I've already mentioned, Plastic Bank. It's the where my I when I bet people, that's the charity. So Plastic Bank as an organization that is looking to reduce the amount of plastic going into the ocean. So whatever you think about climate change or anything else, right? We don't want plastic in the ocean. We don't want to put more trash in the ocean. We don't want more videos of sea turtles with, you know, straws in their nose and things like that.
Yeah.
So how do
I want our plastic straws back. Is that
right.
Can I not say that in front of you?
You can say that.
I miss the plastic straws, yeah. Todd. I love the environment. But...
Yeah. And the thing is that so in the United States, because politicians want us be seen to be doing something about this, what we do is we ban straws, we ban plastic bags. But the United States is not where the plastic in the ocean is coming from. There was a study by Science that found that Sri Lanka, right, this island country off the tip of India, puts 5 times as much plastic into the ocean as the entire United States.
Wow.
So what is banning plastic bags doing to stop ocean plastic? Tiny bit, but virtually nothing. That's not where the problem is. So Plastic Bank says, okay, we got to do something in the developing countries, which are the real source of the problem. So they went to these places in like the Philippines and Brazil and elsewhere, and they hired people. They say, look, pick up the plastic on, and people have, they have an app on their cell phone. So then they geolocate where they turn in the plastic. So you know where the plastic was, and they actually say, we guarantee that the plastic was within this much of a body of water. And they actually have a map on their webpage. They can see where the plastic was picked up. People take the plastic, they turn it into Plastic Bank. They get paid by Plastic Bank on their cell phone because many of these people don't have bank accounts. So now they pay them. Plastic Bank takes the plastic and sells it to SC Johnson. SC Johnson recycles it. So when you go buy a Windex bottle, it will say made with ocean-bound plastic. Now think about the technology involved in that. Basically, cell phones, 93% of people in developing countries have a smartphone or a cell phone. So it's technology that is widely available. It is a web page that they show the location of where they pick up the plastic. So if you're saying, I don't really believe this was ocean-bound plastic, they can show you a map and say, here's where it was. Mm-hmm. Very simple technology, very straightforward. But because the barriers to communication and collaboration have been broken down by information technology, they're able to pick up 3.1 billion plastic bottles using just that system and 140 million pounds of plastic. There's more to do, but just with simple technology, that is way more than banning plastic bags in Washington State has done.
And it solves, as you point out, a number of issues, not just related to the environment. I mean, obviously it helps the environment. It helps these individuals in sometimes third world countries to be able to make some money. And frankly, it helps, is it SC Johnson, you said?
Yeah.
With a little bit of goodwill saying, hey, we're making our bottles out of out of plastic from the ocean. Buy our stuff.
Well, if you go to the store and you buy tuna, would you buy a tuna can that didn't have dolphin safe tuna? No, right?
I guess it's been a while since I bought tuna in a can.
Yeah, and the thing is that now they're all dolphin safe because they recognize that, you know, given a choice between one that says dolphin safe and the one that doesn't, even if the one that's dolphin safe is a little bit more, nobody is going to choose that can without that. And so these labels make a difference. And in the United States, we are fortunate to be wealthy enough to have some disposable income to make those choices. And so, yeah, it's great. It is a market-based, innovation-based approach to solving a problem where politicians are failing.
And does the government have anything to do with that?
No.
Not a hand in it anywhere along the line in the process?
And the reason that these sort of innovative, small technology approaches are taking off is because in many places, government simply isn't an option. The reason that Sri Lanka and the Philippines and other countries like that are putting so much plastic into the ocean is because their garbage collection systems are failing, right? The government is failing at doing its job. So what these solutions do is they fill in the gap for government failure. So yeah, that's the UN has signed a treaty to look at figuring out how to get plastic out of the ocean. Good luck to them. We're not going to wait for that.
Yeah. So are there opportunities? I mean, obviously, we're talking about private sector here. And like you said, free market solutions. Are there opportunities for the government to think small and do things like this that maybe aren't going to get them the giant headlines right away, but that can make a difference over time?
Yeah. So there's one thing that they did at the federal government where they promoted citizen science, where they encouraged federal environmental agencies actually all agencies, to use citizen science. So people who are collecting data out in the real world about where trash is, right? There's a, in San Francisco, there's this famous app, right? Where if you see poop on the ground, you can, you can mark it and things like that.
And we're talking about human poop, by the way.
In the case of environment, I talk about in my book, for birders, there's an app called eBird, where birders can say, here are the birds that I saw, when I saw them, where I saw them. And then that data goes to Cornell University, who created the app. And then they have been able to use that to track migratory patterns of birds and things like that. So now you have this great source of scientific data. So you know what parcels of land are important. And in their case, what they did is they actually paid farmers in California to flood their fields during January and February when birds were coming through, to create habitat. Mm-hmm. So agencies can now use that kind of data to work collaboratively with citizen scientists and landowners and other things like that to find solutions, rather than coming in and saying, we're going to regulate you so that to force you do what we want. So it creates an environment for opportunities of collaboration. So there's a law that, that requires the agencies to do that. That's just one thing. It is hard because a lot of these innovations are nimble. They are on the spot. They're by innovators. Government doesn't do nimble innovation.
No, no.
And so really it is more a case of government sort of stepping back and saying, we have a problem here. Find ways to solve it, rather than sort of actively trying to promote it, because it's hard to know what the solutions are. And so you just want to kind of open the field.
Yeah. And giving people an opportunity to do that in ways where it's not the government trying to make money off of it, right, is big. But it also, in the example that you just gave, it gives people a buy-in to say, like, this is something I care about. I'm part of this solution. I can do something meaningful to help it. And when the government steps out of the way, it's remarkable what people are willing to do sort of in the absence of that. Todd, fascinating stuff. Environment is an issue that I will admit that I have, I wouldn't say blinders to, but I just don't know very much about environmental policy. And so obviously, you know a little bit, just a tiny little bit. So make the pitch for your book, sir.
Yeah. So it's called Time to Think Small. And what I tell folks is that one, it sort of gets them up to speed on a conservative center-right free market approach to helping the environment. So it gives people the tools. Because a lot of these things that what people say is like, when I read it, it was sort of intuitive to me and it made sense, but I just didn't have the words. And so I think a lot of the things that are in there, people recognize it and say, yes, okay. So we'll give them the tools. But then you mentioned that your sort of friends on the left are like, oh, why don't Republicans care about the environment? A lot of the people in this book are on the left. A lot of the, you know, the foreword was written by somebody on the left. So these are arguments and ideas that appeal to people, to sincere environmentalists on the left. And so I think it can be helpful with your family members or friends or others who are harassing you. But let me just give you sort of one last point I think that is really critical. And that is the on environmental policy generally, which is the assumption in environmental policy is that if the government does it, that it's solved, that we assume that government is successful.
Who's assuming that? Yeah, not us.
But there is, it is hard, right? You say, okay, well, you want to reduce ocean plastic, let's just ban plastic bags. And you sort of say, okay, that works. And it doesn't work for a variety of reasons, not all of which are obvious. But the assumption that even the agencies can have your best interests all the time, I think is wrong. And one of the stories I tell is about Flint, Michigan, about the Flint water crisis. And both the state and the EPA denied that there was a problem for a long time. And then finally, when they recognized it, they said, well, maybe we can get these people filters or something. And we have this little bucket of money that we might be able to use to buy filters for people in Flint. And so the EPA debated it. And there was one person who finally said, yeah, we could probably use this money for it. It would be a little bit of a stretch, but I'm not sure Flint is the kind of community we want to go out on a limb for.
Wow.
You have to understand that politicians and agencies are responding to their own pressures, and that putting power in the hands of individuals to care for the environment is not only more effective, it's often more moral. And I think we ought not lose sight of that. And that is why I think conservatives need to have more confidence on these issues, because our approaches in empowering people and not politicians, it is the better approach. We just need to have the courage to say it.
Yeah. Well, Todd Myers, I appreciate you stopping by, and also just the clarity, the knowledge, but also the really, I would say, nonpartisan way that you talk about these issues, I think is so important, just to kind of suck politics out of it and look at effectiveness, look at outcomes. And I think if we talked about more issues based on, okay, what are the outcomes and not the politics involved, I think that we could be far less divided as a society. So I appreciate it, and we'd love to have you back.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Again, a big thanks to Todd Myers for coming on and for that enlightening conversation. Again, the book is Time to Think Small. It's Friday. That means time for our segment, Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Joining us is my sister Miranda, our dogged, very special senior deputy Florida correspondent. Welcome.
Welcome.
I don't know. We can give you whatever label that you want. Okay, I told you we're doing a shorty today because we've got so much stuff to get to in the show. We'll get to an interesting DeSantis story. But first, I kind of laughed when you sent me this article because I thought the headline of it was really strange and kind of didn't have much to do with the actual story. So there's a state lawmaker in Florida who's in a little bit of trouble. For what?
He's in trouble because he used dormant companies to apply for COVID relief during the pandemic. Florida Republican Joe Harding. The article is titled Florida Republican Who Sponsored Don't Say Gay Indicted on COVID Relief Fraud Charges. They love to just throw in these things that aren't really have anything to do with it. But he is best known for his support of the Don't Say Gay bill. So I guess that's why they use that. But in more, you know, important things, he used two dormant companies that he has, including falsifying bank statements to like prove to the SBA that these were fairly successful companies with that were currently running with employees and everything to get up to $150,000 in COVID relief. And he's facing up to 35 years in jail.
Good.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just a straight up criminal. I mean, there's criminal intent there. And I, you know, there was so much fraud over pandemic funds. And I understand that they had to push that stuff out quick. But I mean, like the level of fraud we saw perpetrated in Washington State with unemployment claims and money stolen from Nigeria was just insane. So, yeah, obviously a bad guy. Shame on him. He deserves what's coming to him. But I did have to laugh. Who's that article by?
Politico.
Usually they're pretty good. I had to laugh, though. Like, I get it that maybe that's what he was best known for. But one, it's not the Don't Say Gay bill. It's the Parental Rights and Education Act. But the media just goes with what the opposition called it and just throws it into this headline. And it's just, it's so telling to me.
It is. I mean, this guy did also make one statement, and he said, I want the public and my constituents to know that I fully repaid the loan and cooperated with investigators as requested. So I'm not sure what he wanted to do with that.
It's like, congratulations for paying back stolen money. Great.
Yeah, which is probably more than most people who steal money ever do. So maybe I doubt he'll get anywhere close to 35 years. Maybe because he paid it back, but I'm curious if he paid it back before he was in trouble or after will be the interesting thing to find out. So,
yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, 35 years is a little stiff, in my opinion, for like anything short of a homicide or some sort of string of violent crimes. But people who prey on or people who steal money. I mean, to me, there's a special place in hell for them. Okay, so Ron DeSantis, obviously, he was just elected governor. People, I think, forget that because they're so focused on 2024. And of course, there's an inauguration. And you may attend Ron DeSantis's second inauguration for the price of how much?
Anywhere between $50,000 and $1 million. These are obviously donations that go to the Florida Republican Party. But it would not be Florida without a VIP seat or a table. So he is offering these types of donors VIP treatment at his inauguration. This includes you know, photo ops with him, tickets to the inaugural ball, VIP seats at the dinner, another invitation to a dinner his wife put together for a group that she created. So it comes with a lot of stuff that puts you pretty close proximity to the governor. So yeah, it'll be a very fancy one. Apparently this is not the most fancy inauguration that Florida governors have had. The article goes on to talk about, you know, Charlie Crist and all types of people that had these parades and all types of really crazy fanfare to welcome them into the office of governor in Florida. So
yeah, inaugural bowls, I've been to one. They're pretty common, and yeah, they're fancy, but generally, you know, open to the public. And that's odd. So who's the beneficiary of the money that these people bid on or whatever it is to get this VIP treatment?
So it's supposed to go to the Republican Party, like, because it's fundraising. And this, I mean, as a governor, this might be his last opportunity to raise money for the Republican Party of Florida, because if he does start running for president, I'm sure he's going to have to start raising money for his own campaign. But he's pretty good at raising money. He's proved that in the past. And I'm sure that a lot of people are going to be lining up to become a VIP at this inauguration too.
Yeah. And that's why it's odd to me. I can't believe that's legal. And maybe there's some differences in law in Florida, but it's like, your inauguration is an official event. And to, you know, allow donors to a political organization to come in to get near to the governor, that just all seems a little bit murky to me. I don't like that. I think there has to be a clear distinction between the office of the governor and the political arm. So it's odd to me that he can even do that, but I would assume he would know whether it's against the law.
In the article, this political article, it says five donors who give $1 million to the Republican Party of Florida will be recognized as inaugural chair sponsors. So yeah, to the Florida Republican Party. So I don't know. We could look a little bit more into that for next week and just see if there's any kind of like clarification we can come up with that. But based on this article, that's what it sounds like.
Yeah. And maybe the inaugural, because I know that inaugural committees are adjacent to campaign arms. But for instance, and again, it could just be a different situation in Florida, like the inaugural ball, the governor's ball in Washington state, you know, it's held at the state capitol. There's a lot of public resources that go into it with security, et cetera. So it just would seem so odd for donors to be contributing to. Anyway, Florida is an odd place, but we'll see what happens. And yeah, no doubt that those tickets are going to be snapped up fast.
Oh, yeah, they probably already are, to be honest. So,
yeah. All right, Miranda, we appreciate it.
Have a good weekend.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
And just because I was kind of curious, it just seems, I guess, like when I hear it on its face, that's like he can do like raise political money during his inauguration. Apparently, this is considered a political event. So it's a little bit different than I was sort of thinking. And so for this stuff that they're doing, it's okay to raise money for a political organization as part of it. So, but that, you know, you are trying to get close to, clearly these are going to be donors who want to get close to DeSantis, who want to get close to him, maybe because he's governor, maybe because he's going to be president. But I guess that's how political games work these days. I do want to make one editorial note, because I've been getting some questions about this. Right now, there's a really important trial happening in Washington state. The elected sheriff of Pierce County, Ed Troyer, is on trial because he's accused of, I mean, kind of making up claims against a black newspaper carrier, saying that he had like threatened him when there's some evidence that it didn't go down the way that the sheriff said it went down. And I've been asked, like, why aren't you talking about this? Why aren't you covering it? You know, when I worked at Fox 13, Fox 13 had a very close working relationship with Ed Troyer. He used to be the public spokesperson for the sheriff's office until he ran to become sheriff. There was a lot of charity stuff we did together. So because I've been in a lot of social settings with the sheriff, I don't think it's appropriate for me to cover that trial. So I'm going to defer that to journalists who haven't been in personal settings with the sheriff of Pierce County. Certainly when there is a verdict, you know, I'll happily talk about the verdict in the case. I'm not trying to ignore it, but I do think it's important to tell you why, with such an important trial, such a controversial issue, that I haven't talked about it yet. And that is the reason why. Some requests that we got back to our regular Friday segment. We'd end the show every Friday with our segment Understanding America. It took a little break during the elections, and it is back this week. And we're going to talk about the U.S. obligations under NATO. Obviously, it's relevant with everything going on in Ukraine. Ukraine's not a NATO nation, but there's a lot of NATO nations around Ukraine where if something were to happen, the U.S. would have an obligation. And I wanted to read for you the basis for that obligation. So it is Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, and I'm going to read it for you in full because this is what would obligate the United States to live up to its NATO obligations, essentially, and defend NATO territory if it were to be attacked. And you've heard Biden say over and over, we will defend every inch of NATO territory. And so this is that obligation. Cue the patriotic music. Article 5. The parties agree that an armed attack against one or more of them in Europe or North America shall be considered an attack against them all, and consequently, they agree that if such an armed attack occurs, each of them, an exercise of the right of individual or collective self-defense recognized by Article 51 of the Charter of the United Nations, will assist the party or parties so attacked by taking forthwith, individually and in concert with the other parties, such action as it deems necessary, including the use of armed force to restore and maintain the security of the North Atlantic area. Any such armed attack and all measures taken as a result thereof shall immediately be reported to the Security Council. Such measures shall be terminated when the Security Council has taken the measures necessary to restore and maintain international peace and security. So that is Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, which outlines the U.S. obligations should there be an attack on a member of the NATO alliance. And that is today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Remember, become a subscriber to help support the show if you haven't already. You can do that in two ways at patreon.com/undivided or by becoming a contributor on my Locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. I will see all of you on Monday.